The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 11th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's show, Becca Martin-Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette gives us a quick preview of the Native American Cultural Symposium at the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville that begins this week. That's in our second half hour. Then, after Ozarks on NPR's Here and Now, this summer is expected to bring record heat across the country. That means a lot of people will be relying on air conditioning. But how efficient is the everyday air conditioner? We'll find out from some experts, plus the latest on the summit in Singapore on Here and Now, beginning this afternoon at 1 on 91.3. And tonight, the Arkansas Razorback baseball team plays its last game at Baum Stadium for the year. If Arkansas wins tonight's game against South Carolina, they advance to the College World Series. If the Razorbacks lose, the season is over. First pitch is set for 6 tonight. There is something unusual happening in Benton County this political season. Democrats are running in more races than they have in a long time. And it's happening on both the state and county levels. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek went to both sides of the aisle to find out what's driving blue candidates to run and what it means for GOP candidates, many of whom often ran unopposed in past general elections.
There are a lot of Democrats running in Benton County elections this year, and people like Scott Brownell are taking notice. Brownell is the chairman of the Republican Party of Benton County.
Actually, I don't mind that at all because I think it's exciting. I think everyone has the opportunity to run for political office. Everybody has a chance to do that. So it's exciting to see that. And we'll see what happens in, you know, the court of public opinion, who triumphs in the end or who's victorious at the ballot box.
Of the 8 Arkansas State House districts in Benton County, Democrats are contesting 7. Of those 7, 6 Democrats are challenging incumbent Republicans. There's also a Democrat running in one of the 3 Arkansas Senate districts in the county. District 3 has been held by Republicans since 2004, and an opposing party candidate hasn't run since then either. Brownell feels the Republican Party and its values had been underrepresented for a long time on the local and national levels until recently.
We have had a real change, I think, in what it is that we, not what we stand for, but others understanding what we believe and what we're trying to accomplish. They're getting the message and they're coming on board. And so we have seen for over the last half dozen years or so, this swing toward a more conservative agenda, more conservative outlook.
Although records show many Benton County State House districts have been led by Republicans for much longer, 7 of the 8 districts have had a Republican representative in office since at least 2004. Brownell says that might have kept a lot of Democrats from running in the past.
And I think that with such a strong Republican presence here in Northwest Arkansas, and again, speaking specifically for Benton County, I think it is discouraging when you have a strong party with strong values. Sometimes you don't want to assail that. You just look at it and say, they're well entrenched and we'll pick a better time to use our resources. And that's really more of a political move.
And that political move seems to be in play in 2018.
They have strategized that with the fervor that's coming on a national scale with President Trump, that the Democrats think that this is a good time to try to unseat some of our Republican candidates and Republican officials.
Jessica O'Toole doesn't deny that.
It's funny. I was actually born a Democrat, I think, in a Republican family, and I've just always been that way.
O'Toole is a member of the Benton County Democrats. She joined when she recently moved to Benton County after spending 10 years living in Ireland with her husband. O'Toole says the experience changed her perspective on politics in the U.S.
I just grew up never considering that you know, any of these freedoms we enjoy could be taken away, or that everyone in the world doesn't experience the same rights, especially that women in the United States experience.
So when she moved back stateside, O'Toole says she immediately wanted to get involved in the local Democratic Party.
I did find that it did seem like there was an older generation, and that they had experienced some challenges, especially when Hillary lost the election, and it was really difficult for people to cope with, and feeling like a lot of the work they were doing, maybe they weren't getting the results they wanted.
But O'Toole says Hillary Clinton's loss and the election of President Trump has also motivated her and other young people to not just vote, but to get involved, and in some cases, to run for office.
I saw a lot of opportunity as being one of the few young people involved. I was really excited, and I just felt this energy, especially being fueled by, we can do something about this.
That something turned out to be Progressive Pints, a Facebook group O'Toole and a friend started last summer.
At first, it was a support group for liberals up here in Benton County, because I think there are a lot of us, but it's easy to feel like there's no other person out there who might think this way.
The concept is simple. O'Toole says the group would meet every other week to talk politics over a pint of beer.
What we started doing was, if we had a meetup for drinks, we would first go to a city council meeting or a county council meeting and really advertise it like, let's go to a meeting, learn what's going on in your government, and then go out for a pint and meet some new friends.
Some of those friends are now running as Democratic candidates for office, from state house and Senate district races to races for seats on the Benton County Quorum Court. Gayatri Agnew says joining Progressive Pints is a big part of the reason she's running in House District 93 against Republican incumbent Jim Dodson.
One of the things that came out of that group was a transparency to how our local election processes work, which seats are open, which seats, when filing deadlines are, how you would even choose to run, where you would file, how, like, just this transparency to process, because it does, even if you're paying attention, it does feel like a lot of mystery, and it shouldn't.
And Agnew says it was the women in the Progressive Pints group specifically who convinced her she has what it takes to run for an office that represents a large portion of the city of Bentonville.
A number of the women in that group asked me, and the first time someone asked me, I was like, oh, you're joking, ha ha ha. They said, well, would you ever consider running? And I kind of paused and I laughed, because when someone asks you something that makes you uncomfortable, you laugh. And then I looked at her and I said, maybe. I don't know. Do you think I should?
And a lot of other women have been convinced to run, too. Out of the 7 contested races in the House, Democratic women in Benton County are running in 6 of them. Agnew is also one of the thousands of people who have moved to Benton County, and Bentonville specifically, in the last 5 years. Before that, she grew up outside of San Francisco in California's Bay Area.
I felt like my whole life a little bit of a fish out of water until I moved to Bentonville. And then I was like, oh, I get it. I was always supposed to live in a small town, right? Like, literally, my friends tease me. They're like, oh, you're finally home. It's great. You wanted to be able to know all your neighbors and to walk to the farmer's market.
Agnew says she knows the small town she now calls home is changing, and that she is part of that change.
What I've observed in town is that we have an incredible cadre of committed leaders, and a lot of those leaders are deeply concerned with the future of our community, but those leaders all look the same. And I mean this in a very respectful way, right? They're all older, they're all Caucasian, and they're all male. And that's not a bad thing, but they're all like that.
Agnew says Bentonville needs a more inclusive leadership base that reflects the growing diversity in the community. When she was considering running for office, Agnew says one of the factors that ultimately led her to file to run was wanting to see more of herself in her leaders.
I gave a lot of thought to things like the fact that I'm a mom, I have 2 toddlers, I'm a biracial woman, I'm in a biracial marriage. These are all things that I notice and I observe are different about my family, but they're the same differences that new people coming into Bentonville often have too.
And Agnew isn't only concerned about physical diversity. She says diversity of experience is just as important, because legislators tend to think about policy in the framework of who they are.
I grew up on welfare. I was raised by a single mom. My mom's an incredible woman, and I learned a lot from her. And that experience isn't better or worse than somebody else's experience, but it's going to change the way I think about how we approach social services and supports for single women, because I have had a very different experience than other perhaps older or male legislators may have had.
There are plenty of men running as Democrats, too, One of them is Sam Slayton. He's running for Benton County Justice of the Peace in District 8 against incumbent Republican Shirley Sandlin and Libertarian Jeff Wadlin.
I'm running because there are 15 Justices of the Peace on the quorum that make up the quorum court, and there are 15, all 15 of them are Republican. The entirety of Benton County is not Republican, so I do not think that it is representative of the makeup of the county. In particular, I don't think it's representative of the makeup of Bentonville, which my District 8 almost is entirely Bentonville.
This election, 9 of the 15 Justice of the Peace positions are in contested races. And Slayton says that's good, especially for people in District 8.
Folks in District 8 haven't had a choice at the ballot box in 10 years. There hasn't been anyone other than the incumbent, other than potentially a libertarian here and there, in 10 years. And I feel like when you have leadership that stagnates, ideas start to stagnate, and then the constituencies or the communities in which their constituents live begin to stagnate as well.
Although Slayton did mention he believes it's unfortunate that justices of the peace run on partisan tickets.
I don't think there are a lot of partisan issues at the county level. It's primarily about maintenance of county roads, caring for the homeless population, making sure all those things are kind of taken care of. So I feel like, unfortunately, these races can get a little bit skewed by the rhetoric surrounding the national politics. It can kind of infect some of that local stuff.
Slayton is part of the changing demographic of Bentonville, too. But he says those changes spread beyond the city, as people who move to work in Bentonville live in other parts of the county, which means there's a demographic shift happening there, too.
The fact that we're seeing so many different offices opposed this year is reflective of these broader changes, that folks don't just want to see changes at the street level, you know, in terms of new places to eat, new places to shop, new places to play, new mountain biking trails. They also want to see that change reflected in their leadership and how their leadership thinks about leadership.
Jessica O'Toole of Progressive Pints says by supporting candidates like Slayton and Gayatri Agnew in their races, they're making room for more voices in Benton County.
This area can be a bit of, I'm trying to think of the word, you know, a dichotomy where it's like, you know, the old values that are really important to people, which are completely understandable, the things that we're proud of in this area that, you know, but we also need to include the new people who are coming in, and people can have a really positive impact in making this a great place to live.
The group's other goal, O'Toole says, is to give voters a choice when in some instances they may not have had one for a while. In House District 93, for example, until this year, that seat had only been contested by an opposition candidate once since 2004. Records show 4 other House races in Benton County haven't been contested in the general election since 2012 or 2010. That's why Scott Brownell, the chairman of the Benton County Republicans, says 2018 is gearing up to be an exciting time in local politics.
I welcome the competition. It keeps us keen and sharp and doesn't allow us to get lazy. And the last thing that we want is a lazy political party that thinks we don't have to work.
Brownell says the county party is supporting candidates who may not have had an opponent to contend with before.
They are obviously aware that they have competition, and so they may be a little bit more keen about what they're doing, strategizing resources, and we do that here at the local level as well with our county resources and our fundraisers, and have to make decisions about which races may need a little bit more help than some of the others.
And Brownell calls the Republican candidates running in Benton County well-qualified and experienced.
I believe we're going to do very, very well come our election.
Jessica O'Toole is feeling positive about what could happen in Benton County come November, too.
It can be kind of a secretive place where you don't really know what the person next to you is thinking. So I feel like this is a very exciting time, and it will be really interesting to see what happens. No matter what, we're laying the groundwork for the years to come. But I think that we are in for some really good surprises in November.
Until then, both parties agree, there's much campaigning to be done, not only to educate voters about each candidate, but to get them to come out and actually vote. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
The general election takes place Tuesday, November 6th. This is Ozarks at Large.
The 2018 Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball season continues at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. Group and season tickets, as well as game stats and more, available online at nwanaturals.com. 91.3 is supported by the Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville, it's open daily until 9 p.m. Admission is free. 273-1329 or walmartmuseum.com.
Still to come on this Monday edition of Ozarks, medical marijuana isn't rolling yet in Arkansas, a year and a half after voters approved it. But some people who would qualify for medical pot are already using.
But I also said, you know, you put it here. It's an herb. We all have receptors for it. So it's a natural thing to do. And I'm asking you to bless it. Now, I'm not going to worship this cannabis. I'm going to worship you. But I'd like to use this tool.
That story ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
Support for KUAF comes from contributing listeners and from KUAF's sustaining members. Monthly sustainers of KUAF form a strong foundation, providing reliable and steady support for the programs, salaries, technology, and more that's needed to make this public radio station strong. Thank you to the more than 1,000 sustaining members of 91.3. We appreciate your support.
This is Ozarks at Large. Over the past decade, children enrolled in early child care and pre-K settings, according to national data, are being suspended and expelled at escalating rates. So the U.S. Departments of Health and Human Services and Education issued a joint warning several years ago telling states to take action. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the Arkansas Department of Human Services is taking a lead role in developing interventions.
14 groggy Asbell Elementary pre-K students are just waking up from their 1 o'clock carpet nap for snack time. Goldfish crackers dipped in peanut butter. Their teacher, Amber King, says these kids are mostly well-behaved, but when needed, she and her pre-K paraprofessional, Sheila Wright, practice what's called conscious discipline.
That is where we can teach the kids to kind of handle their own emotions and just how to calm themselves.
Public preschool teachers in Arkansas can also turn to Behavior Help Response System, a new intervention program operated by the Arkansas Department of Human Services to help children in distress, as well as to reduce or even eliminate preschool suspensions and expulsions. Tanya Williams, director at the Division of Child Care and Early Childhood Education, administers the program, available to more than 200 publicly funded pre-K schools as well as child care centers across the state.
Now, we frequently get into situations with early care and education programs and teachers. I myself have been out in the field where teachers are just saying, I can't deal with this situation.
Situations where children may be harming themselves, completely lack self-control, or are damaging classrooms. Teachers at wit's end can go online to the Arkansas Department of Human Services Behavior Help Response System, designed by a suspension and expulsion prevention work group. Launched in July of 2016, the system coordinates key training, technical assistance, and mental health consultation resources across the state with the goal of assisting early childhood educators in need.
We actually work with two of our contractors that are very expert in early childhood child development. One is focused more on classroom structure and supporting the teachers and helping them understand child development and what would be appropriate, but also maybe rearranging classroom space and the environment and maybe implementing, you know, some structure there. The other is more on the mental health side and, you know, mental health interventionists that work with children in the early ages.
Department of Human Services early childhood education contractors will repeatedly travel to schools to observe and assess children and develop intervention plans.
Sometimes the situation, you know, resolves itself with some of these tweaks to the classroom environment, to the structure within the classroom, and a few changes within the curriculum or the teacher or paraprofessional. Sometimes it's a more serious situation and may require mental health and social-emotional supports beyond you know, even what we do in terms of contracting. We may work with a local mental health institution to work with the family.
In the first year of implementation, 2016, the program underwent development and testing, Williams says. In 2017, 264 children ages 1 to 7 were served. 10 ended up being expelled, 4%. Nearly half had experienced abuse or neglect, divorce, or parent incarceration.
I think there were probably way more children getting expelled prior to that, and probably there are children getting expelled that we don't even know about.
In a published report on the program, 86% of teachers surveyed said they'd use behavior help again and recommend it to colleagues to help young children manage distress.
For young children, they don't know how to express that yet. That's why so much of this comes out in very inappropriate ways, because they don't always have the verbal skills to express what's happening or their frustration. And so when you have folks that are trained early childhood teachers and interventionists, they can help that child navigate that and really build resiliency skills and self-regulatory skills that go beyond these preschool years into K-12 and into higher ed and to workforce.
Arkansas's behavior help response system has become a national model, Williams says, due to the work of Arkansas Department of Human Services early education expert Arlene Rose, who recently retired. Kathleen Hale is pre-K director for the Fayetteville Public School District, which operates pre-K programs serving 140 children in 6 different elementary schools funded by Arkansas Better Chance for School Success and federal preschool development grants. Hale says preschools offer youngsters a secure routine starting every weekday morning.
When the children arrive, they are brought in by an adult who's responsible for them and signed in so they don't ride the school bus. Once they come into the classroom, we greet them. We greet their family members. They wash hands first. Then they put their things in their cubby and they go to breakfast. After breakfast, they will typically either transition directly to learning centers or they'll transition to a large group carpet time, which often includes a lot of math and a lot of community building. After that, they will spend one-third of the day in open choice of learning centers. And the centers include dramatic play, library, sand, water. They have music and movement, blocks. They have a safe place, which is a conscious discipline designed area for self-regulation. And they have a series of other opportunities in art as well. So there may be art centers. One might be easel. The other might be art and collage that can be done at a table setting. And then each teacher designs their room in a unique way. So there are little differences from each classroom to the next.
And conscious discipline is widely practiced in her district's preschools.
Conscious discipline, it's a program designed by Dr. Becky Bailey. All of my staff have been trained in the conscious discipline techniques. Some of them have been trained in-state. Some of them have gone to conferences and met Dr. Bailey herself and learned directly from her. The whole program is based on brain research, and the intent is to provide not just the opportunity to develop a school family and develop that camaraderie and that sense of belonging, but also to give children skills to develop self-regulation and to also learn very specific skills that involve cross-lateral movement and self-regulation in terms of how they process information and in terms of how they react to situations that they come across.
Hale says teachers and paraprofessionals in her district do refer children to the state's new intervention program, Behavior Help, but only after extended meetings with families and exhausting local behavioral health resources.
We have seen an exponential rise in challenging behavior over the last 10 years. It is rather remarkable.
Hale says expulsions don't occur in her district. Tanya Williams says the root cause of misbehavior can be traced to exposure to trauma, for example, divorce or death, and toxic stress.
Either abuse or situations that are certainly not appropriate for young children or probably even adults to experience. Everything from abuse to mental health situations with adults in their lives, inappropriate adult interactions.
A recent national survey of children's health found that 22% of children ages 2 to 8 in Arkansas have a diagnosed mental, behavioral, or developmental disorder, the highest rates in the nation. Kathleen Hale also traces misbehaviors to other triggers.
Sometimes due to environmental factors. It's also sometimes due, we think, to exposure to inappropriate media for the age of the child. There are a number of factors. A lot of our families are economically under-resourced, and they don't have access to a lot of the things that they would need to have access to in order to have a more calm and predictable home life. Families who are facing being evicted, who can't pay their electric bill, families who are in constant crisis, highly mobile, they don't have the luxury of providing all of those things that would be considered a well-rounded environment for a preschooler.
According to Kids Count Data Center, a project of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, nearly 200,000 infants to preschoolers are being raised in Arkansas, a population in decline post-Great Recession. Nearly one-third of Arkansas children receive some form of public assistance, indicating certain economic stress. But the good news is that emotional, social, and mental health resources, most notably DHS's behavioral help, are available to struggling preschoolers and their families at no cost to them. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And as with many stories that you hear on Ozarks at Large, links that will take you further into the story are available at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Arkansas hasn't issued any licenses to grow medical marijuana yet, but that's not stopping some patients. Last week, the state Supreme Court took up a lawsuit that stalled the licensing process. The suit questions the picks made by the Arkansas Medical Marijuana Commission in March. Bobby Ampazon with Arkansas Public Media reports some patients who would use marijuana for medical relief already are.
Matter of fact, it's time for me one now. I ain't had one all day.
In Pine Bluff, an Army veteran of three wars sits at a table in his garage, the centerpiece of which is a decorative tin filled with marijuana cigarettes.
Now I'm good.
I visited Levon Lee a while back. His last tour in Iraq a decade ago ended with a truck accident following an explosion. He had surgery on his knees, and his doctor prescribed pain pills.
I took about 14 different kinds of pills a day. But I was looking like a zombie slobbering out the side of my mouth.
When he wasn't slobbering, he was doleful. And his wife finally said, enough.
Then I went left and went up to, because I had got to the point that I didn't want to even live anymore, you know. Those pills had me feeling that way.
I don't
want to
live.
I don't want to live.
Suicidal.
Yeah.
Lee will qualify for medical marijuana when it's available, but it's not stopping him now. In the last year, I've met a lot of people who use marijuana as a therapy, even as a cure. Jack Cross in Eureka Springs is one. He says cannabis and Jesus Christ cured him of his prostate cancer.
Well, there's cannabis. I understand that, but that's this marijuana thing and so forth. And I was wondering what he thought of it. But I also said, you know, you put it here. It's an herb. We all have receptors for it. So it's a natural thing to do. And I'm asking you to bless it. Now, I'm not going to worship this cannabis. I'm going to worship you. But I'd like to use this tool. And I just felt this relief. So I knew right then and there that was the answer.
Cross is open about his therapy. He has a website, cannabiscancerhealing.com. But he admits it's risky.
If you went and got your stuff in Colorado and then drove back, you'd have to come across Kansas and Oklahoma, my friend. And that's bringing what they consider a Schedule I narcotic across state lines. That's a federal offense. So, you know, it's a spooky thing. But it's amazing the doors that open when you're living right with the Lord.
Cross was prescribed painkillers at first, like Lee, and he was pretty disgusted with it. One state research center keenly interested in the potential of marijuana to impact opioid rates is the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement. Craig Wilson's a director there.
So there were a couple of publications in the New England Journal of Medicine that
showed a loose association for states that had passed medical marijuana and reduced opioid use. They stated in their limitations that they were unable to look at an individual level to see whether or not opioid use had been reduced. We are actually the first state to be able to link these two data sets together to actually take a look at the individual level.
But Dr. Rick Smith, a psychiatrist and an architect of the state's AR Impact, the new interagency program to fight opioid abuse in the state, says marijuana is not medicine's answer to opioid addiction or even pain management.
Doesn't add anything, in my opinion, and it adds a destructive element in that people are, A, smoking it, and B, it's a step toward legalizing marijuana, recreational marijuana. And I think marijuana is a gateway drug.
As of the first of the month, almost 5,400 people have successfully registered with the state health department for legal medical marijuana when it becomes available. And that's not expected before 2019. In Little Rock, Bobby Ampazon, Arkansas Public Media.
Support for 91.3 and Arkansas Public Media come from Simmons Bank, with more than 90 community-based locations in Arkansas, providing banking and lending services. Dreams realized. SimmonsBank.com for more. Additional support provided by Arkansas Children's Northwest, providing fast access to pediatric experts specializing in kid-size care. Arkansas Children's Northwest is located in Springdale, across from Arvest Ballpark. Information at archildrens.org/emergency. The Trillium Salon Series and members of the Artisphere Festival Orchestra will present an evening of 21st century chamber music Monday, June 18th at 21C Museum Hotel in downtown Bentonville. This event is free, but seating is limited. TrilliumSalonSeries.com for more.
We've hit the time of year when sunlight lasts for about as long as it can. This makes reading in a hammock or on a patio a possibility into the evening. So we've asked Pastor Clint Schneckloth to give us a summer reading list, and we hear his first recommendation today, a beast of a book that's more than a foot tall and is an unusual autobiography, Monograph by Chris Ware.
If you remember, maybe, a couple of years ago, this same author, Chris Ware, published a book that was building stories, and it was a block.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can still get it. Like, I still see it at, like, Barnes & Noble and stuff. It's like, it looks like a block, and you got it, and it was all these stories that take place in this one building, like an apartment building,
right,
about these families and individuals that live there. Well, so Chris Ware is... He's a darling of the graphic storytelling genre, and knows everybody. Everybody loves him. He gets gigs with, like, the big publishers. So he does, you know, inserts for the New York Times, the New Yorker, a lot of big magazines. And then he also has done all this publishing himself of various kinds of books. And this last year, he came out with this thing, which is, like, literally, I could sit this in my chair and you could talk to it because it's that big.
It's huge.
And he admits in the beginning it's totally self-indulgent, but people wanted him to do it, so he did it. And what it is it's kind of like a autobiography, but in the way that Chris Ware would do it. So at the beginning, there's kind of like an introduction to it, and it has really big people who are writing introductions to it.
Ira Glass
wrote the preface for it. And then there's a big thing with Art Spiegelman.
Of Mouse fame.
And so there's a kind of a introduction. The way a lot of artists or writers would tell you, like, how did I get into art and how did I start drawing and this kind of thing. But then... because Chris Ware is Chris Ware, he doesn't just tell that story, but he includes and has kept record of the whole process and development of him kind of emerging as an artist, as a child.
I can't emphasize enough how big these pictures are, these photographs and these drawings that you're showing me in this book. They're huge.
Yeah.
I mean, a page could be taken out and put on a wall in a frame, and it would seem like a normal-sized painting or photograph.
Right. Yeah, or you could mount the whole book as, like, a poster on the wall. So then you know, he features a lot of photos of his family and himself early in his life. And then he starts to show, like, you know, art that he drew and what he started to create himself as he started to emerge as an artist. And one of the things I learned getting this book, I was given this, thankfully, for Christmas, and it's just been really fun to spend time with it. He's not just a graphic novelist or cartoonist. He also does these three-dimensional creations. He builds, like, machines out of paper, or sometimes he creates out of clay the characters that then will be in the comic strips. And so there's pictures of those artifacts. And then all around, so what he does is basically, part of the reason the book is so big is it's laid out so that you can put up frames of what he drew, and then you can have side commentary about telling you about how he created that character or what impact it had.
Yeah, what's interesting is the images are huge. The type is pretty small.
Oh, that's what I'm saying, is it would take you a very long time to read it. I'll just take sections at a time and just kind of read about, you know, here's the dollhouse that he built, or here's this mechanical painting toy. He built a mechanical painting toy that if you push a button, the character on top of the box paints.
Wow.
And he creates that kind of stuff. And then inside the book, periodically, not every page, but just on some pages, there's actually three-dimensional stuff in here. So, like, here's a little sample of a Jimmy Corrigan novelty comic, and there's the whole 10-cent comic taped onto the page.
And it's on the same page as a New Yorker cover that he did.
Right.
I love that.
Well, I love it because every time I look at it, first I'm kind of like, how did anybody ever make this? You know, like, that just blows my mind. And then I'm inspired to, like, think, well, what could I make? You know, everything that he's making here, it's coming, emerging from his brain, and then he sits down and starts to get at it. And it's so fun as a blend between classic art and, like, the kind of the comic and toy. Like, a lot of the stuff that he makes is, like, he's just designing toys from scratch that then become part of these comic stories.
I know you got this for a gift, but any idea what this runs? Because this is a massive tome.
Yeah, you know, surprisingly, it wasn't as bad as I thought. So it lists for $60, but I feel like I was given it, and it was ordered from Amazon, and it was, like, $35 on Amazon or something.
Oh, wow. Monograph, Chris Ware. A great introduction, or if you're a big fan already,
right?
A great addition to your collection.
And if you want to know, I mean, he's one of those guys where it may not be for every taste. So, you know, go online and you can see some Chris Ware stuff and see if it's your kind of thing. But yeah, it's pretty fun.
Pastor Clint Schneckloth is the lead pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. And this week we'll hear his summer reading suggestions on Ozarks at Large. Today he discussed Monograph by Chris Ware.
Ozarks Electric Cooperative has changed a lot in 80 years, but the mission of providing power has not. Ozarks serves more than 75,000 meters in northwest Arkansas and northeast Oklahoma, plus supply energy solutions, bringing progress to the region. Owned by those served, OzarksECC.com for more. The Museum of Native American History in Bentonville presents the second annual Native American Cultural Symposium June 14th through the 17th, featuring Native cultural leaders Walter Echohawk, Shutez Cot Martinez, Bunky Echohawk, Brooke Simpson, and more. Details and registration at monah.us. 91.3 is supported by Clubhouse Fitness, striving to help Arkansas become one of the healthiest states in the nation by offering personal training, over 70 classes weekly, and access to outdoor activities. Located on Dixon Street and on Joyce Boulevard in Fayetteville, plus Little Rock, and online, clubhausfitness.com.
It is Monday, June 11th, 2018. This is Ozarks Large. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Okay, one of those little quirky, weird things about me. I always wanted to have some kind of interesting heritage.
Oh, right. I'm the same way, and I'm not going to do that 23andMe because it's going to come back.
Yeah.
European boring.
English, Irish, Scottish. Eh. Have a nice day. The best I can give you.
I got German. I do have German.
The best I can give you is that, according to someone who was doing family history 100 years ago, allegedly all the Bacons came from a land grant to Sir Francis Bacon, who gave the land grant to his nephews. Hmm. And here we are.
How about that?
But I think it would be amazing to, like, be Cherokee or to be something.
Right. And don't you think is that the one that I'm thinking?
23andMe.
I think if it's doing anything right now, it is poking holes in these family legends.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I always heard I was part this.
Maybe not.
Right. However.
However, you don't have to be part anything Native American for this huge event that's coming up next weekend, hosted by the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville.
Right.
It's the Native American Cultural Symposium, and the topic this year is reunification through reinvention, the creative visions of contemporary Native America. So they're going to do all these cool things, not talking about the Trail of Tears, not talking about the settlement of Indian Territory, not talking about any of those things, but talking about being Native American now. The keynote speaker is a guy named Walter Echohawk, who was born at Pawnee, Oklahoma,
okay,
and went to law school. And at the time, it was a big deal.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because he was born in 1948. All so right. He said that his parents wanted to see some change take place in our tribal community in the late 60s and really encouraged me to go to law school. There were so few American Indians in law school, you could have counted them on your fingers and toes.
Wow.
And he's done a lot of work with equality for Native Americans under the law and for tribes. And he said, you know, really, this is a social movement, just like women's rights, just like African-American rights.
Sure.
It's a social movement. And he speaks at 7 o'clock June 15th at The Record in downtown Bentonville.
That's a Friday night.
And then there's a play.
Right. It's a script in progress, right?
Right. That's part of the Theater Squared New Play Festival.
But also part of this.
Right. And I don't know how to say the word that's in the title. It's about Sacagawea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Crossing However They Said the Missouri River.
Right.
Minose?
Something
Minsone?
Like that. Yeah. Yeah.
The playwright is Mary Catherine Nagel, who is also pretty unique because she's Cherokee.
Mm-hmm.
She's a successful attorney.
And a playwright.
And a playwright. And so this is drawing the connections between the Missouri River and what it meant during exploration to the current situation with water.
Okay.
And then it's Unpronounceable Name Day. They have this great activist who's going to be there talking about the environment. He's like 17 or 18.
Oh.
And his name looks Mayan.
Mm-hmm.
And is pronounced Shutescat.
Okay.
Martinez.
Shutescat Martinez.
He's amazing. He's written a book. He's recorded with Quincy Jones.
Well.
Yeah. He's amazing. And he's going to talk about how we can individually do things to save the world.
What we can do to make a difference?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's amazing. I've read part of his book. He speaks at 2 o'clock the 15th at The Record.
Okay.
And then he performs at the Forest Concert Series at 7 o'clock the 16th at Crystal Bridges.
And again, 15th is a Friday, 16th is Saturday.
And his book is available at the Museum of Native American History. And
right.
He'll be signing it.
All right.
It's going to be really cool. And they're going to have shuttles running between the museum and the Bentonville Square. So you can go to stuff at The Record, and then you can go to stuff at the museum. And then there's stuff at Crystal Bridges, and you've got the Theater Squared New Play Festival and the Forest Concert Series at Crystal Bridges and all these things all coming together in this weird synergy of stuff. And if you're confused, you're not alone, but you can go to Mona, MONAH.US.
Right.
And see the whole schedule.
Gotcha. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
My name is Robert Palmer, and I'm from Arkansas. That's blues country. I worked my way through school playing blues and jazz in juke joints and roadhouses.
Little Rock native Robert Palmer is probably best known for his 1981 book Deep Blues and the 1991 film of the same name he narrated, and as a music writer for the New York Times, Penthouse, and Rolling Stone. He also taught American music at several universities. But Palmer's greatest legacy might be producing a series of albums in the mid-1990s which reinvigorated that most Arkansas of genres, the Delta Blues. While many non-fans say the blues all sounds the same, these albums could scarcely be more different from one another. There's the delicate Junior Kimbrough, the raw Cedell Davis, the juke joint sound of the Jelly Roll Kings, and the bright slide guitar of R.L. Burnside, heard here. And all were released on the fledgling Fat Possum label of Oxford, Mississippi in the 1990s. Label owner Bruce Watson was inspired after taking one of Palmer's courses at the University of Mississippi. Fat Possum Records prides itself in not keeping the blues under a glass case and in tweaking those who would. And the label's reputation was largely established through Pulaski County native Palmer's efforts. Blues music enjoyed renewed popularity as the 20th century ended. The reissue of Robert Johnson's 1930s recordings, for example, sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Scholarly study in its history had increased too, due in part to Robert Palmer's work. But the newer sounds of the blues were often smooth, predictable, and bland. The blues with Robert Palmer at the board are anything but slick. These Robert Palmer-produced records introduced Arkansas-er Cedell Davis, Junior Kimbrough, the Jelly Roll Kings, R.L. Burnside, heard here again, to the world. More importantly, these albums stayed closer to the roots of the blues in another way. They were recorded in, and performed and recorded by, Arkansas-ers and Mississippians. All the performers have been playing blues for years, but were little known and little recorded. At a time when blues music, traditionally performed by outsiders on society's fringes, was used in selling the likes of macaroni and cheese in casinos, the authenticity of the players in Palmer's Fat Possum Productions is palpable. Born in 1945 in Little Rock, Robert Palmer was also a musician himself. He tells of sneaking out of the house as a young teen to play sax and clarinet in nightclubs, like the South Main Businessmen's Club on Little Rock's 9th Street Black Entertainment Strip, and in county line honky-tonks like the Club 70 and the Blue Room in his book Rock and Roll, An Unruly History. The 1995 book was a companion to the 10-part BBC and PBS series of the same name. Palmer played clarinet also in a little-known psychedelic band called Insect Trust, which released two albums, one on Capitol and one on Atco. He didn't perform on any of his Fat Possum productions, but Palmer can be heard here on unissued sessions that Palmer arranged for Cedell Davis of Helena, Arkansas. Born in 1927, Cedell Davis played with fellow Helena-born slide guitar great Robert Nighthawk in the 1950s and 60s, and Cedell developed his own singular raw slide guitar sound by playing the guitar upside down with a butter knife due to the effects of polio on his hands. Wheelchair-bound Davis of Pine Bluff was nearly 70 when Robert Palmer produced his 1995 debut album called Feel Like Doing Something Wrong. Hey, now, baby. Junior Kimbrough was also an older blues man whose debut long player was produced by Robert Palmer. Kimbrough operated a juke joint outside Tullahoma, Mississippi, and played in North Mississippi for decades. Charlie Feathers and Stan Kessler, both later employed by Sun Records, grew up listening to Junior Kimbrough. Kessler produced Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Wooly Bully by Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, while Feathers wrote songs like I Forgot to Remember to Forget. Robert Palmer also produced Kimbrough's follow-up, Sad Days, Lonely Nights. Junior Kimbrough's hypnotic guitar style is subtly dangerous. It also lends itself to long dances and trance jams. In 1997, another Robert Palmer-produced album was issued on Fat Possum called Off Yonder Wall by the Jelly Roll Kings. Arkansas-ers Frank Frost and Sam Carr joined guitarist Big Jack Johnson, who was featured prominently in Palmer's film Deep Blues. They made up the rocking blues supergroup, the Jelly Roll Kings, heard here. Arkansas-er Robert Palmer's decades-long interest in the roots of the blues through writing, recording, and film helped spawn a national re-interest. At least in some circles, R.L. Burnside is well known today. Hip-hop remixes of Burnside's songs sold surprisingly well for envelope-pushing Fat Possum in the 1990s. Burnside's music could be heard on car commercials and in the TV series The Sopranos. Burnside's song Going Down South, heard earlier in the program, has been adopted by latter-day bands like the John Spencer Blues Explosion and the North Mississippi All-Stars. In 2002, Phillips County native Cedell Davis recorded an album with rock and roll stars like R.E.M.'s Peter Buck, and it was recorded by another Little Rock producer, Joe Cripps. Jelly Roll King Frank Frost, who died in October 1999, has a street named for him in his native Helena, while area native Sam Carr, the son of Robert Nighthawk, is considered the premier Delta blues drummer. Junior Kimbrough, certainly one of the most innovative blues guitarists ever, died in January 1998. His rockabilly disciple, Charlie Feathers, died that August. Kimbrough's legendary Chullahoma, Mississippi juke joint, seen in Palmer's film Deep Blues, and where Palmer recorded Kimbrough's albums, burned to the ground a few months after Kimbrough's death. The building had reportedly stood for more than 130 years. Robert Palmer, a graduate of Little Rock University, now known as the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, died November 20, 1997. Here in its entirety is Junior Kimbrough's Done Got Old, recorded in 1992 at Junior's Juke Joint in Chullahoma, Mississippi, from the album All Night Long, produced by Little Rock native Robert Palmer.
Well, I done got old. I can't do the things I used to do. I'm a
Kimbrough's Done Got Old from his album All Night Long, one of a groundbreaking series of 1990s blues albums produced by Little Rock native Robert Palmer. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
A listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for spending part of your Monday with us. You can always subscribe to us as a podcast. It's absolutely free. We're available as a podcast through almost all, if not all, of the major podcast suppliers like Stitcher, Apple TV, iTunes, and the others. If you have any questions, we do have the answers at KUAF.com. You can find links to the stories you heard today, as well as entire interviews, the entire shows, at OzarksAtLarge.com. And don't forget, there is a KUAF app. It, too, is free, and it brings you all of the KUAF channels and recent editions of Ozarks at Large at the touch of a fingertip. It's good for most phones and tablets. Have a great rest of your Monday.